So, Seamus, it's that time of year again where people have to rewrite their checks or something. Wait, how do birthdays work again?
I don't know, but yeah, it is that time of year, especially for me. This goes up on Monday. So if you're listening to the show on Monday, tomorrow I turn 50. And I would just like to say that the internet has ruined birthdays for me. Okay, I'm bad at remembering birthdays. I remember a couple. But you know, some people are good with birthdays and they always remember birthdays. And in the pre-internet world, I used to find it so gratifying when somebody would remember. You know, I'd have like that one friend that would be like, "Happy birthday, Seamus." I'm like, "Holy cow, this person remembered my birthday." And that just like made me feel like loved that somebody would go and remember my particular birthday of all their friends. And I never took offense if nobody remembered my birthday. You know, I never expected anybody to remember it. So when somebody did, I always was just delighted by it. But now it's the age of the internet. And when it's your birthday, social media tells everyone. And so it's impossible for anyone to It's impossible for me to have that moment where I know that one person actually remembered my birthday, because now everybody just gets an automatic reminder. Today is Seamus Young's birthday. Why don't you wish them, you know, why don't you send them a greeting?
Yeah.
And that just ruins. I know I haven't logged into Facebook in months, and I know I could log in right now, and there will be 30 people that I haven't talked to in a couple of years. And they'll all wish me happy birthday because Facebook told them to. But I'll bet you one of those people actually remembered it was my birthday. And I would rather have just had that moment of delight finding out that one person actually remembered my birthday. What an awesome person. And instead, that moment is robbed. I'm robbed of that moment. And they're robbed of the recognition of like taking notice in me and like the effort they put into remembering my birthday. And it has made our relationships colder instead of warmer. And so the internet has ruined, social media has ruined birthdays.
See, I've gamed the system by telling Facebook a fallacious birthday. It's not off by much, but it's off by more than a day. And so when people say happy birthday on my Facebook birthday, I know you're just listening to the Facebook robots.
Right. That's a good way to handle it. I realize this is the ranting of an old man. Literally now, the ranting of an old man. I think at 50, you can officially call yourself an old man. I say I can log in right now and have those birthday wishes, but actually, I won't get those until tomorrow. Anyway,
Yeah. I'm
all the
always
time.
terrible at remembering birthdays also. So
Me too. That's one of the reasons I just am so delighted when somebody remembers mine, because you know, I feel like, well, I don't remember your. I like you, I care about you, I think about you sometimes, but I don't remember your birthday. But you took the time to remember mine, and that makes me feel appreciated. So, all the topics this week are mine for whatever reason. So we're gonna mix them up with some mailbags. So let's just jump right into the mailbags. What do you say?
okay, let's do it.
You can take this first one.
Okay, do you want me to? This is the so if you remember last show, audience, we talked about someone who sent in a treatise on video games, and this is it. We've arrived now. It's coming. You need to duck into your foxhole.
Right. This is their, what do you call that paper that you write just as you become a graduate?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not a term paper. It's like your dissertation.
Your thesis.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'll just read the beginning here. Anybody who wants to read the whole thing, it's not going to be, if you're watching this on YouTube, it's not going to be the YouTube description because, as we talked about on a previous show, there's a character limit on that thing. So I'm not going to be able to fit this whole thing in there. So you're going to have to go over to Seamus' site and read it if you want to read this whole thing. It's got some good insights in it. I really like it, and it's spurred some thinking, but I'm just going to read the first part. Dear Diecast, in discussions about a game's difficulty, the concept of artificial difficulty often pops up. This form of difficulty is usually considered a flaw in a game, or at least inferior to the good old farm fresh difficulty. However, the distinction between what tends to be called artificial difficulty and difficulty seems to be rather, well, artificial to me. And I have a feeling that these terms create more confusion than bring clarity. What are your thoughts on the term artificial difficulty? With kind regards, Marvin. I had to scroll all the way to the bottom before I read that, right. Which is why it took so long. With kind regards, Marvin. P.S. Thank you both for making such an enjoyable podcast. Thank you, Marvin, for your excellent question and your own thoughts. We really appreciate it because it helps us to think about it in a clearer way.
So I don't run into this. I run into this term once in a long while, but I don't run into it often on my site. And so to me, it feels a little alien. I'm not sure what people mean when they say artificial difficulty, because I mean, all difficulty is artificial, isn't it? You can make something as arbitrarily easy or as trivial, you know, or as impossible as you want when you're making a video game.
Well, kind of. I mean, you could imagine like a character creator, right? Where like every time you change a feature, you have to do a crossword puzzle. And like that would be artificial difficulty. But you can't make it arbitrarily easy because you do have to actually like change the character in some way.
Right.
So there's a limit to how easy you can make the character creator. There is some inherent difficulty in like, what hair color do you want? The game doesn't know. You have to tell it somehow.
Right. I normally pull difficulty apart into three pillars. Okay. The first pillar is just what we think of as difficulty normally. The skill. You know, the thing you have to perform, it's some sort of timing, some sort of memory, whatever it is, you need to do it. That's the main pillar. Secondary is punishment. You know, what's the cost for failure? You know, the first is how easy or how hard is it to fail? You know, or if 99% of the people are going to fail this on their first try, that's a hard thing to do then. If everybody gets it on the first try, then that's easy. But like, you know, where do you draw the line on how, you know, where it falls on the skill spectrum? And then there's the punishment. What happens when you fail? You know, how much are you going, how punishing is the game? Oh, you made a mistake and you died. Start over. Okay, that's pretty harsh punishment. Or, you know, you lose all your items. Or the monster, you made a mistake and now all the monsters get more health. So the game is even harder now. These are all very punishing designs. Or you can do the Half-Life thing where it's almost like anti-punishment, where the game kind of like starts pulling its punches when it looks like you're about to go down.
And you get more loot in the ammo boxes when your ammo's right. Low, that kind of thing.
Right. It'll still kill you. I mean, if you just stand in the open and like drool on yourself, the Combine will shoot you to death. I've died enough times to prove that. But you know, it creates, you know, the it's that cushion at the bottom of the at the bottom of your failure slide there, where it's like, oh, okay, you're down to 10% health. We're gonna give you a few seconds where everybody's gonna miss you. And that'll create this moment. You have a chance to create that moment of just barely scraping by, getting what you need, and pulling through the fight and wiping the sweat from your forehead and going, whew, that was a close one. Or maybe you'll just die 10 seconds later. But it gives you that little extra oomph. And the third pillar is like knowledge. Like there's certain things that just... you have to fail them on the first try to figure out what you're supposed to. Nobody is expected to do this on the first try. You have to fail it a few times in order. But once you do have the knowledge or experience, I mean, we can, you know, make an arbitrary one of like, here's 100 doors, pick one. Okay, you picked one. Wrong, you die. Start over. And then, you know, eventually you'll learn that it's door 22. And now every time you get to that point in the game, you know to pick door 22. Now it is trivially difficult. Now it is trivial when before it was very difficult. So, I mean, that would be horrible design. But that's just an illustration of how of how that's not really skill-based. That's knowledge-based. So you've got skill, you've got punishment, and you've got knowledge. Now, when we talk about artificial difficulty, which of those three pillars are we manipulating?
It feels like the skill is the normal difficulty and the other two are the artificial kind. But, I mean, that's just me.
Okay, I agree with you there. I didn't want to say it first because I felt like I'd defined all the terms and I didn't want to just... And here's what I think and you need to agree. But okay, we are on the same page. We both kind of feel like there's the skill of what you have to do. And then you can arbitrarily, you know, it doesn't have to be that hard. But if you make it extremely punishing, people will say the game is hard.
Right. If choose your own adventure book has super low punishment, right? Because you can just flip back to the page you were on. There's no punishment for failure. But it has often, I mean, they're very low information where you're just like, well, you just guess what you're supposed to do and like chart your way through this thing. And they don't give you very much information beforehand or else it would be trivial to choose the right path, the quote unquote right path.
Right.
And then I guess the opposite would be like Dark Souls where it's obvious what you have to do. Like just kill the thing, just kill that monster and then just kill the next monster. Just don't die and kill the thing. Like there's no information requirement, but then the punishment is also much higher.
Right. And it requires quite a bit of trial and error to like get the feel for the timing. Oh, here he's winding up.
Yeah, it's got some information difficulty as well there.
Right. Like the quintessential thing I see in some bosses are, okay, he winds up. And so somebody will immediately, I'm going to dodge. And they dodge. And then, but the boss kind of hovers, you know, has his hammer up in the air and holds it there for a second and then brings it down. And that interval is just happens to be about as long as it takes you to do a dodge roll. So, so the designer deliberately made this so that if you attempt to dodge when you notice the attack, you'll take it on the chin. You have to learn the timing. And maybe there'll be a couple of different attacks and they'll each have their own, like, here's one that is very fast, but comes in from the side and you can't do that kind of dodge roll. You need to back off. And here's this other move, but it's got this weird timing that'll throw you off. And there's, I mean, you got to practice. It's like anything else. You got to practice until you get a feel for all the timings.
It's kind of like the opposite of a rhythm game, where a rhythm game gives you all the timings, and then it's just the execution of, like, knowing it far enough in advance, right? And in this one, it's like, oh, you don't know the timings. It'd be amazing if there was, like, something like Dark Souls mixed with Crypt of the Necrodancer or something.
Right. Like, all of a sudden, you fight a particular monster, and now you've got to do it on the offbeats. This one, you got to dodge on dotted eighth notes. Have you seen that some, you know, people have begun doing no-hit runs of Dark Souls? I'm sure you've heard about that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. People try no-hit runs of everything. I mean, like, Ikaruga is the classic.
But somebody did a no-hit run of the Dark Souls trilogy. And I think they included Bloodborne. So that's four games back-to-back-to-back-to-back and never getting hit.
Yikes.
And, I mean, you can imagine what that was like just trying to attain that for the first time. You get 6 hours into the run and you take a hit and it's like, oh, time to close Bloodborne and go and open up Dark Souls 1 and start over.
Well, I mean, if I was doing it, I would practice the area where I got hit a bunch until I could do it without getting hit and then maybe start over. But yeah.
But I think these people have just practiced the game to this extreme degree. It's not that they don't know the timing. It's that, you know, after 8 or 9 hours, you just get tired.
Yeah. Does it have to be done as a marathon? Can you, like, take the weekend off or something?
I don't. Well, I think you're normally expected to do it while streaming. just so that people can see you doing it live. Because otherwise, you know, it's real easy to just splice together a run that looks legit, but you can't fake it if you're playing through it live.
I suppose you could pre-record the game footage and then live stream your face in the corner so you can respond to chat and look like you're doing it live.
Right. Although that has it's easy to get caught like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
You mess up the timing. You look away.
You have to like have a pause window or something that you could bring up that pauses the video and like puts the game pause screen on.
Right. Right. And that sounds like a lot of trouble, but it's probably still easier than just learning to beat all four games without getting hit.
Oh, man.
Whew.
Yeah.
So I feel like we haven't moved any closer to knowing what artificial difficulty is. And I think this is worth talking about. But what is I know what people are talking about where it feels like a game is sort of arbitrarily throwing up obstacles and wasting your time. Or it feels like the game is not respecting your time.
Sure. If there's like a primary skill challenge and then there's some other mini game or something that you have to engage with and you're like, I don't care about this mini game. I just want to like be doing the primary skill challenge.
Right. Or you could have it something that just belabors the point, like a 2-minute long quick time event. Can feel art, you know, that starts over if you fail it. And it's like, well, that can feel pretty artificial. Because, you know, it's like, how long can you go without making a mistake is different from can you perform this task?
I feel like there's also a kind of difficulty that's, what is like, a lack of tools difficulty. So, like, if you imagine trying to play City Skylines, but without, like, tools for knowing how much power you're using, right? like you don't know how much electricity you're generating, and just like you get brownouts and you don't know how much more generation capacity to build, and so you just have to kind of like guess, and like that would be a lack of tools difficulty kind of thing. And I feel like there's a lot of games that kind of insert that kind of difficulty, like incomplete information, I guess, is a similar thing where they're not giving you all the information that you need to make the choice. Or they've got some sort of task that would be really easy to automate in the computer, but instead you have to do it all by hand.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Like if you had to lay every piece of the road by hand in City Skylines instead of just like dragging a big long line. Like that would be tools difficulty.
Right. Just crappy tools.
Or like, yeah. Or in Dyson Sphere Project, where for a while, I think they've added since I played last, but for a while they didn't have any templates. Like you couldn't like copy a whole section of things and paste it off somewhere else. So like that would be a tools difficulty thing where it's like, well, this isn't a problem of like gathering the resources or knowing how to build these buildings. It's just a matter of like clicking all the right spots to build all the things that you need to do the thing that you want to do.
Right. A game where you can't like tell how accurate a weapon is or how much damage it does.
Sure, sure. Well, and there are a lot of games where you don't see health bars, right? Where it's just like, well, you just keep fighting until the enemy dies.
Right.
I think Hollow Knight is like that, where like no quick travel system, where like you can get from one place to another.
That's a good one.
It just takes time to get there, and like, well, there's no challenge in traversing. If there's no challenge in traversing the space, then it's like, well, this is a tools problem. This isn't a problem of like, it's not difficult because it is hard. It's just difficult because you're making me do this thing that it would be easy to automate.
Right. A game where you really need all these resources, but you can only carry so much. So you have to make multiple trips.
Yeah. Although, I mean, a lot of the inventory management games are like that, where do you make multiple runs just so you can carry all this stuff back to town, or do they just give you a bigger inventory? Like with weight limits and things, is that really a difficulty thing or is it just a hassle?
Right. What is the purpose of inventory limits? Like that's not me being a smart ass. That's like, okay, well, why is this limit there? Why can't I just carry infinite stuff? Is that for realism? That would be one, you know, one reason to limit inventory. Another one is that so you have to make especially if it's a game about resource management, then you have to make strategic decisions about, do I want more bullets or more healing?
Mm.
But some games just seem to like do inventory because that's what games do.
Right.
Although there has to be a theoretical cap on it, I guess. Just to keep your save file. I mean, if you can carry an unlimited number of... Mass Effect 1 is a great example of... It was such a pain in the ass to sell weapons. And it was just so tedious and cumbersome that I wouldn't do it. And then you would just have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. They're automatically... You don't gather them up after a fight. It just automatically deposits stuff in your inventory. So you don't even know what you've got at any given moment. It isn't like you see it going in.
Oh, it's like the opposite problem. It's not hard to like pick it up and carry it. It's hard to get rid of it.
Right. And so for me, every time it was at the same point in the game, it would be midway through Vermeier, just before the Vermeier survivor dies. I would go to pick something up and I'd get a message. First time in the game, my inventory's full. And there's nowhere to sell or get rid of items at that point in the game. You are in the middle of a big important mission and you can't just like piss off back to a store. And that happened to me in multiple runs and I finally like, all right, somewhere around the halfway point of the game, I stop and clean out my inventory. But it takes a long, you know, after Vermeier, I'd go back and everybody's like, oh, I can't believe so-and-so died and this is so tragic. And I'm like, I'm going to go down to the basement and sell all this stuff to the weapons guy. I'll see you guys in 15 minutes.
Yeah, and that's so silly in Mass Effect especially. You're supposed to be like this super spy, cyber ops, you know, like assassin slash investigator slash senator's aide person.
Right.
And like, why are you picking things up on the battlefield? There should be like a quartermaster that just handles all that stuff. There's a team that does a sweep after you come through and secure the area, and they do all the... It's probably illegal even to like loot the battlefield like that. Isn't that
right?
Isn't that against some sort of international interstellar law?
Right? Can you imagine like Obi-Wan and Qui-Gon get back to like the temple and they're like, oh, that was a tough mission. Then Obi-Wan just opens up his robe and he's got like 50 pounds of blaster rifles and robot parts and you know...
Right.
Bantha dicks right. In his sack and he just dumps it all out and starts selling it and he spends like 2 hours selling stuff to some guy with three heads and Qui-Gon is just sitting
sets
there.
Up a flea market right there in the temple.
Right.
It's so silly. So there you go, Marvin. Inventory limits are artificial difficulty and they're silly. You should get rid of them.
I feel like I took us off mission, but I'm more interested what people have to say about artificial difficulty in the comments. I want to hear other people define this term and get a feel for what they think of it.
Nice.
All right. So every month for the last, I don't know, 6 or 7 months, I've gotten, you know, a little notification. Oh, your payment to Xbox Game Pass. And I'm like, that's right. I signed up for Xbox Game Pass and I'm not using it. I should either use it or cancel it. And on one hand, I mean, it's a business expense for me, right? Like, that's part of my job. Like, if you run a website and you post articles, you don't, like, cancel your stock photo account because you don't need any stock photos this week. It's just, you know, sometimes we need that, so we keep this account open.
Hmm.
And that's the purpose of it, you know, is, oops, I don't have anything to write about this week. Let me find a game and play it until I find something to talk about. That's the thinking anyway. Xbox Game Pass, there's a huge library, and that'll give me stuff to talk about. But really, when it goes for 7 months, it's $15 a month. That's money I didn't need to spend. It wouldn't bother me if I didn't use it every month. But if I go for 7 months without using it, then I really need to cancel it.
Yeah.
So I opened it up. Actually, Windows Update. It was the weirdest thing. There's a Windows Update waiting. And I was like, oh, fine. Fine. And after the reboot, the Xbox Game Microsoft PC Xbox for Xbox Game PC, whatever this stupid thing is, whatever this oxymoronic product is called, was open on my computer. Like, it just decided to launch itself. And I'm like, oh, that's weird. That's weird, but okay. Let me look through. Here's a huge library of games. I should find something and just play it this week. This was a few hours ago. So I start scrolling and I start scrolling. Oh, maybe you play a Halo. I haven't played Halo since the first one. That might be a good conversation. Oh, wait, no. You have to pay for the Halos. You don't get any of those for free. So the only game I wanted to play was
the original one.
Maybe the original one. I actually didn't see it in the list. But anyway, I scroll through this list and I'm like, no. None of this seems interesting to me. And then I come across Solitaire.
On now, Game Pass?
Yeah. Microsoft Solitaire Collection. Now, I'm old enough to remember Windows 3.1. And I don't mean from childhood. I mean, I had a day job. And I'd go to my day job. And then when no one was looking, I'd open up FreeCell in the background and fuck around. Because, you know, that's what you do. You're supposed to be working. So I got really into FreeCell there sometime in 1994 or so. And I had fond memories. But then, you know, Microsoft stopped including FreeCell with versions of Windows. I think maybe Windows 98 was the last version to have it. So it hasn't been part of Windows this century.
Are you sure? I think it's an option when you install Windows, you can tell it to install like the games package or whatever and just stop being on by default, maybe.
Let me look and see what I've got. Yeah, it's not on my machine. But anyway, Microsoft Solitaire. So I remember back in the day when this was just free and everybody had it. And I'm like, all right, I feel a little nostalgic. It's been 26 years since I played FreeCell. Let's give it a shot. Maybe not 26 years, but it's been more than 20. So I fire it up. And then it's like, hey, you've got Game Pass. With Game Pass, you get to play Solitaire with no advertisements. I'm like, what? Why would there be advertisements on fucking Solitaire? It's like, our hamburgers contain no asbestos. It's like, do you need to advertise that?
And it's an advertisement that they put up in front of the game, right? Telling you that you don't get advertisements.
Right. So then I play my first game and I win. And it's like, You won. You gained 100 XP. You unlocked this many game chips. You've unlocked some new backgrounds and some new card decks. And, oh, you've leveled up to level 2 FreeCell player. And I'm like, what is this? What has any of this got to do with FreeCell? So then I play.
Did it open up a world map for you?
Open up a crafting menu.
Yes. You can craft new cards, powerful new cards.
And then I get to the end of the game and it does its little, well, the end of the first game, it did the little, like it did back in the 90s, where it has each card fall from its place and bounce along, leaving a trail of identical cards behind it, which even
right.
in the 90s.
It suspends the redraw buffer.
Right. Even in 94, I thought it was a pretty cheap effect. I was always like, boy, I know how you did that. That is low effort. But it made me happy to see them doing that here in 2021. But anyway, I completed the second game, and it started setting off fireworks, and then it locked up and crashed.
Wait, what?
It crashed. In the middle of fireworks, it just paused. And like hung there for a second and then just vanished in shame.
Did at least the little window come up saying, don't worry, we're going to report this problem to Microsoft?
Nope, nothing. It just vanished.
What? Double standard.
Right? But I just, you know, the elves, how they would, in Tolkien's elves, would always be so somber, and they're always bitching about how the world used to have so much magic in it, and now it's all gone. And everybody's like, what is your problem? I feel like that now. I remember when this game was free, when it was simple, and when you could just play it and whenever you wanted. And now it wants to be online, and now it wants to like advertise that it doesn't have advertisements. And now it wants to like give you game points and achievements and unlock levels and level up. And now it friggin' crashes. Even though the game is exactly as complicated as it was in 1994. And I feel like all that is beautiful in the world has gone away. We are left with this giant poisoned industry of advertisements and broken technology.
Yeah, I did just reread The Silmarillion recently, and I feel you.
This is exactly what the elves went through. This is exactly it.
An end has come in Middle Earth to story and to song.
Unless you're willing to pay $15 a month.
It still crashes.
Right? And it's still advertised, not having advertisements, and it still gives you levels. Okay. Hey, Seamus. I recently discovered a Let's Play of Mass Effect called The Saddest Party on the Citadel, where the player got every sidekick killed so that they could have, as the title suggests, the saddest party in the Citadel DLC. Seeing as you played lots of games multiple times each in order to review slash analyze them, have you ever tried to spice up your nth playthrough by essentially trolling a game like this? For example, in Skyrim, I once pickpocketed everyone and stole everything in Riverwood, leading to my character maxing out the associated skills before the game had even properly begun. Provisional username. So yeah, I've done this for a few games. I don't know if I trolled the game, but I've done weird things just to experiment with systems and see if I can break them. I can't remember them all because they're usually like I don't save them. I don't usually make them part of my write-up because if I complain about anything, people will say, "Well, it's your fault for playing the game wrong." So it's not a lot of fun. So I usually keep this stuff to myself.
The run you did with the cheat engine, it kind of reminds me of the same kind of thing, right? Where you're like, let's see
That's
what happens
true,
if I kill
yeah.
this thing in the tutorial when I'm not supposed to kill it.
Right. Yeah, now the proper way to do that would be to just grind for like 12 hours to get to that level. But like you just use friggin'
Stay in the
cheat
forest,
engine.
killing boars.
Right, just use cheat engine and get on with your day. Another thing I did in Human Revolution, there's a dumb feature. If you pick up a gun, the gun goes in. You were speaking about, inventory systems and inventory Tetris. You pick up an SMG and it'll put the SMG into your inventory. You can open it up and see the SMG. And if you pick up another SMG, the SMG evaporates into nothing and just the bullets go into your inventory.
Oh yeah. I remember
Right.
that. Yeah.
And that's terrible because SMGs are actually worth a lot of money. Especially early in the game. And the enemies early in the game drop tons of them. So one time I just decided to see what would happen. So I'm up on the third floor of a building and I clean out all these gangster cyber dudes that are guarding some bullshit that I don't even remember. Whatever. I either killed them or, gave them all naps. So then I pick up one SMG. Now, if I pick up two, the second one will evaporate. So I pick up one SMG. I walk all the way down to the first floor, go through the loading screen, walk a few blocks away, and find the shop, go into the building and find the shopkeeper and sell the SMG. Then I walk a few back blocks back to the building, go through the loading screen, go up three floors, and pick up another SMG. And I was gritting my teeth the whole time. I mean, this just took ages. But I did. I sold them all. And I had as much money as you would normally have at the end of the game. And it, the game had just started.
Oh, my goodness.
So I don't know if I was trolling the game or if the game was trolling me. That's a borderline case there.
Did it make a difference, like, having all that money?
Yeah, there are a few points in the game where in a normal playthrough, you won't have enough money to buy these praxis points as soon as they become available. Like, you get to the set, like, every zone has a shopkeeper, every city you go to has a shopkeeper that sells praxis points. And, you know, they're like, I don't know, a few grand a piece or something. And normally, when you first get there, you don't have enough to buy that praxis point. And maybe you'll even have to wait until you leave that area, go somewhere else, and then come back later and buy it. But during this playthrough, I was able to buy all of the praxis points or skill points, if for those who haven't played the game. It's just your love. This is how you level up. And I was able to buy them as soon as they were available. So I was more powerful, sometimes being 1 or 2 points ahead of where I'd be in a normal playthrough, which would, you know, it was nice. I don't know if it was worth schlepping those guns, but it was it was nice.
It didn't trivialize anything.
Right. Yeah, it didn't. It didn't give me. It would have been interesting if shopkeepers had just a whole stack of praxis points that, you know, they didn't have a cap. They could sell as many as you could buy. Then I would have been able to break the entire game right there. You know, buy 20 praxis points. Just, you would have to do, there's a zone you go through, and I normally sneak through it because, boy, there's a lot of guys. But if you were to do that section loud, you would get dozens of SMGs, and it would be enough to completely pay for an entire game's worth of praxis points right there. You could walk to the store and buy, you know, just fill out the leveling tree. Get all the powers.
And some of the zones are, there isn't a shopkeeper in them, right? They're like a special instance or something.
Right, right. Yeah, so I think there was maybe 2 loading screens. One to exit the building and then one to go into where the shopkeeper was. Yeah. Ugh. I've done weird, dumb, obsessive things. Back in the day when I played Descent, for whatever reason, I played Descent really wrong. Looking back, I just played it wrong. I played it the way you would play a survival horror. Just like super slow and methodical. You're supposed to dogfight. It's a game about dogfighting. Jump out in the open and unleash a bunch of lasers and missiles and blow everything up. And I'd play peekaboo with, you know, the robots and jump out and shoot at them and then jump back into cover. And I tried to always keep my shield topped off. And I've never done that in any other game. And I've never really, like, figured out why did I do that. That's a very boring way to play Descent. And that isn't how I normally play shooters. Normally I played shooters, high action, run around in the open like a crazy person. You know, especially shooters of that day, your Quake, your Doom, all that stuff. So why did I play Descent that way? What was it that made me, why did I do that?
You know, it might have something to do with our next topic.
Ooh. I actually forget where our next topic is.
So back in Wolfenstein Enemy Territory, there was this problem. There's a video that Seamus put in the show notes, and it's fascinating. There's this problem where players were not only reporting, but actually achieving higher kill rates with one gun rather than another gun. And the problem was that the guns had identical stats in every way. Like they were completely the same, except that one of them had different sound design. One of them had a bassier, heftier sound, and the other one didn't sound quite so intimidating. And it was actually affecting the way that players were like able to kill other players in the game, in the multiplayer.
Right. You so I wonder feel if more in Descent.
Yeah.
If there was something in Descent that made me feel weak.
Yeah, well, if like the sound design or the way the enemies sounded or whatever made it seem more intimidating than it really should have been.
Right. It was also really early in shooters. And maybe I hadn't realized that that was a boring way to play. It's hard to remember. I mean, we are talking about almost 30 years ago, and my memories are pretty dodgy at this point. Like, I remember playing Descent. I remember the loading screen taking a while too. I remember it took a long. Now, of course, it starts instantly. I
Yeah, just
but
let
like.
Microsoft publish it. I'm sure they'd fix that.
But like, how much Doom did I play before I moved on to Descent? I believe Descent was the first game I, yes, Descent was the first game I played where you could look up and down. And so that's why I'm an inverted mouse person. You push the mouse forward to look down and pull it back, pull it towards yourself to look up. Because that's, you know, how flight sick, that was the default controls in Descent. So then when Quake came out, that just felt natural.
Another way in which you played the game wrong.
It. I'm not wrong. It's the children who are wrong. I am fascinated by this story about the nerfed gun in Wolfenstein Enemy Territory. I totally missed this story at the time. But yeah, two guns, one for each, you know, what is this? It's a Axis versus Allies. And the Axis gun had a bassier sound, and so players felt more powerful. And it was all in their head, except that actually translated to more kills. They would just go for it more often and just run out in the open, and you would feel more powerful. And I wonder how much of that is the enemy also felt weak, like they were more likely to rout. You hear that big boomy gun coming after you, and you want to run away. You know, or stay in cover. And so,
I'm really curious if it would have the same effect if it was a really large player base and a really long time. Or if that effect would wash out eventually as people learned not to be afraid of the sound, right? If the
right.
effects weren't there. Like if this was PUBG or something and there were millions of people playing millions and millions of rounds, if the effect would wear off or if it would remain.
And if the gun itself was one of many. Like, one of the problems with Wolfenstein is, you know, this was your sort of bread and butter gun. This was one of the main guns that players would use. Where in like a PUBG, where there's a huge selection of weapons and you never know what you're gonna get. And so it would
True.
get, yeah, so it wouldn't dominate the numbers so much. I don't know. That's an interesting. It's a. It, I'm fascinated by it because it shows how much game design isn't about the numbers. It's about our perception of the numbers. And that's really hard to design around. You can sit there and make your platonic ideal game where everything's perfectly balanced according to the spreadsheet. But that doesn't necessarily mean people will perceive it that way. A lot like in XCOM, where it feels like you miss when you shouldn't. Even though, you know, statistically, oh, it said you had a 5% chance of missing, and you did. And it seems like you know, when you get those numbers, it feels like you shouldn't miss. Oh, you know, the odds are never as high. It misreports the odds. And no, the odds are correct. It's just that you notice when you miss. A 95% feels like you should never, psychologically, it feels like you should never miss. And you miss all the time at 95%. You miss one out of 20 shots. Although in that case, part of the problem is that it is just a number. Like there is no, okay, you are one square away from this person and you're holding an automatic weapon and they're in front of you. That's not 95% to chance to hit. That's 100%. I'm a trained soldier. How could I possibly miss an entire turn of shooting my automatic weapon at somebody who's literally close enough to smooch?
Right. Empty the mag. You don't have a jam. Somehow you miss.
Right. I think that is an unaddressed flaw in the system. It's kind of like critical failures in D&D. Oh, you rolled a one, you failed. It's like, really? really my professional person doing something, this professional thing fails 1 out of 20 times. You know, imagine pizza driver, run 1 out of 20 pizza deliveries, he crashes his car.
Yeah. I think the idea in D&D, and certainly this is not the way that a lot of people use it, but I think the idea is that you only roll for stuff where it's actually a challenge, where you're actually being challenged with something difficult. You don't roll to walk down the sidewalk.
Exactly. I think that is the root of that problem. Because, well, we got to roll the dice a bunch because that keeps it interesting. And it's like, yeah, but now you have, you know, people failing to do their jobs.
Yeah.
All right.
Dear Diecast.
Oh. Whose turn is it?
I think it's my turn.
Okay, go for it.
Dear Diecast, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on the ongoing Blizzard fiasco. Do you think good and healthy video game company management is truly possible? Or is it inherent due to the unstable nature of game development and human dysfunction? Love, Donkey. I really wish that you didn't have such a funny name, Donkey. Because this is a very difficult question.
For me, I think it's interesting. Some disciplines are very stable. I mean, there are assholes everywhere in the world, but you don't see entire industries dominated by idiots. This is something I want to make a video about, where we have an industry being run by people who don't understand the industry. Like, Walt Disney was the foremost expert on family theme parks. Can you imagine if Hugh Hefner was trying to run Disney World? And they, you know, he's not a family guy. He didn't have any kids. He doesn't know what it's like to try and take a family on vacation. Walt Disney had this intuitive understanding of what the customer was looking for when they show up at Disney World. And Hugh Hefner, although also a very successful businessman, would have failed at that same, would have failed at running Disney World because he did not have that domain experience. And that is what I see going on in the video game industry. And it is weird that we have basically all of the big companies run by, well, Ubisoft, Activision, and EA, the big three, run by non-gaming executives. And those are the most dysfunctional companies. Those are the ones that have all this. I mean, it's not just that they're not gamers. They are also not software developers. They are not entertainment guys. They are just like business dudes. And that is weird. That is really weird. Go to any other domain and you will not find, I mean, you'll find that a little bit everywhere. It happens. You know, a son inherits a company from his father and the son doesn't know anything about the business, but he inherits it. Stuff like that. Or just somebody blunders their way into being in charge or whatever. But the big three are all, and I think that's the root of this dysfunction. So yeah, good and healthy video game company management is truly possible. We hear very good things out of Valve Software. Gabe Newell, an executive, knows the business, is a software developer, was a game developer, understands the jobs that people do, and the company absolutely runs fine. People love it there. It's everybody's dream job.
Yeah, absolutely. It's certainly possible.
It is absolutely possible. So yeah, I don't know much about Japanese. I'm always really shy of commenting on Japanese companies, but my intuition is that the people running Nintendo understand the business. I don't know if it's nice to work there. I don't know anything about life in Japan or how it compares to working at other companies, but I've never gotten the impression that, oh, the people running a Nintendo have no idea what video games are all about.
Yeah. Yeah. It certainly is possible to manage it well. Although I think that, you've identified some problems with the management, like the kind of people who end up in charge of these companies. But I think the problem also stems from the kind of people who are attracted to working in these kind of environments. And I want to draw a parallel between games industry stuff and working for Elon Musk companies, because both of them have this kind of mystique about them of like, oh, you really want to work there. They're doing really cool stuff. They're doing stuff that people want to do, and it's attractive. But and that's great. But as a result, the kind of people who end up working there are the ones who are willing to make sacrifices that no one else is willing to make in order to do
Yes.
that. So you do attract the kind of people who are willing to work for 80 hours a week when you're working on rocket ships that are going to go to Mars. Like, and there's nothing wrong with that. If you want to do that and you're willing to make those sacrifices, that's absolutely your decision. But then if you just want to work on rocket ships going to Mars and you're not willing to make those sacrifices, it gets really hard to get into the industry. And so it makes it feel like the industry is oppressive and it's really, it's soul crushing. But really, it's just that there's so much supply of people who want to do this thing that they can afford to be choosy. The people who are hiring people can afford to be choosy and just pick the ones who are going to work the longest hours
They
and
can, yeah,
require the least amount of benefits.
they can, from their perspective, they can hire all the doormats. And you're like, but I don't want to
Right.
be a doormat. I just want to, work normal hours. And it's like, well, then you can't work at this sexy company because this sexy company has just an endless army of doormats wanting to work there. And I think this also goes back to knowing what you're doing. I think if, yes, there are the those people that are just willing to let the company walk all over them. But if you're an exec, if I tried to do that at Valve Software and kill myself with 80-hour work weeks, somebody there, Gabe, I mean, it probably wouldn't be Gabe personally, but let's just, for the sake of illustration, Gabe would say, hey, look, I know you enjoy working here, but this work will be here next week. Well, this work will still be here on Monday when you come in. Go home. Not because I don't want a bunch of free labor from you, but because actually writing code, if you've been writing code, if you spend 80 hours writing code a week, those last 20 hours of code are going to be really shitty, and I don't want people to have to fix your bugs.
Right.
Like you're causing problems. I understand the job is fun, but you need to take breaks. It is physically important to do this because this job is very mentally taxing. You shouldn't, but you can work on an assembly line and drill bolts, for 80 hours a week. And those bolts will still, bolt the thing together. But for creative jobs, your mind disengages eventually, and then the quality of your work drops off drastically. Again, this is something that you would know if you understood the industry. And it's something that is opaque to you if you're Bobby Kotick and you just sort of like, oh, whatever, just, make me games as fast as you can. And we'll just put out games. And I'd have no idea how to judge the quality of the work being done or the final product that's produced. And we'll just sort of like spam the world with games like we're a virus just making copies of itself.
Yeah. Oh,
No
and that's another
concept.
aspect, which is like you're saying, if you don't know what the quality of the work is, like if you don't know how to judge it, then it's really difficult to figure out if people are the people you're managing, if you're doing a good job managing them or not. And
Right.
like a friend of mine hired a company to make an app for them, and but they're not a coder. And I was like, oh, it's not a good plan.
No.
Like there's because they give you a benchmark, like, oh, hey, we made progress to this point, and like here's how far we got, and like how do you know if that's reasonable or not? How do you know if if they're on their way to making what you want or not? Or how do you know if they're just stringing you along until you run out of money? Like you have no idea. There's no way for you to tell that. Whereas if you have even a little bit of skill in the area, then you can be like, oh, I see what's going on. Oh, okay, you're working on this, and you can give them some real guidance as opposed to just like, do it faster for less money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If you don't know anything about the quality of the work, then that's the only thing you can ask for is do it faster for less money. And that's when you push for that, that's unreasonable, and you don't know if what you're getting, and you don't know if the quality is dropping off. That's a really great way of looking at it. Yes. And that's essentially what Bobby Kotick is doing. Oh, also, he seems to be asleep at the switch. I mean, it's just like rampant, like all these human resources problems where even if he's a sociopath, it doesn't care about the people that work for him. Like, come on, you know what's up. You've seen the news. You know that doesn't end well. Oh, we have a guy with 50 sexual harassment complaints against him. It's just fine. I'm sure it's nothing. I'm sure that's not anything that requires my attention.
Oh no.
Right? Like, even if you don't care about your people, even if you literally care nothing for them and you just see them as disposable equipment, you've seen the news. You know how that ends. It's
Yeah,
like, what
you
is
wouldn't let
that guy?
someone just like walk around installing like Bitcoin mining rigs on all
Right?
your development PCs and burning out the graphics cards. Like even if you don't care about the morality of it, it's still burning up your resources. Like those things are
Right.
expensive.
What's this guy to you? What's this guy to you? Is he like your buddy? Is he related to you? No, he's, he's five steps down the totem pole from you. He's, you don't even know his name, and he's causing all these problems for you. Just fucking fire him. What do you do all day if you're not managing people and you're not judging the quality of your products? Like, what does Bobby Kotick do when you have no
Marketing,
understanding? You
apparently.
right? So yeah, that's my I'm trying to gather up all those thoughts and turn them into a rant that's different from everybody else's rant. Like, everybody else's rant is, hey, companies should be nice to us and companies should behave and be responsible. And I kind of want to do a video of like, okay, I'm going to take the position of a rhetorical businessman who only wants money and doesn't care about his people and thinks they're disposable. And even judging on those criteria, Bobby Kotick is still an absolute garbage fire of a leader. Just embarrassingly incompetent. I need to look up and see if he actually owns the place. Like, this is a distinction most people don't make. Like, Elon Musk is in charge because he owns the friggin' company. He wasn't.
Right, it's his money.
Right. Where, on the other hand, Andrew Wilson was hired by some board, some entity that owns Electronic Arts, and they have hired this person to do the job. And
Well,
I
it doesn't
haven't.
even own Electronic Arts, right? It's a publicly traded company. They're
Right.
tasked
But
on behalf of the owners with managing
right.
the company.
Right. Right. On behalf of the shareholders or however that works. And I don't remember which Bobby Kotick is. If he owns the place, then well, then I guess it's his to run into the ground. But
Right. As
I have
incredible as that sounds, it is his prerogative to just burn it all down like the Joker on a pile of cash.
Right. But I'm willing. Nobody else owns it except for like Gabe Newell. Like, these companies are so big. I'd be surprised if Kotick was actually an owner. But I don't know. Kotick has been in the business for a long time and spent a long time wheeling and dealing and running different companies. So before I write my video, I need to look that up and figure that out. It makes the argument easier to make if he's hired by somebody, because then I can make the case that they should fire him. But what percentage of Activision is publicly traded? Who has controlling share? Is he burning down his own company, or is he grossly mismanaging somebody else's assets?
It
Anyway.
looks like he owns a non-controlling stock in Activision Blizzard.
Interesting. Well, that does make it easier to make my case that he should be ousted. Preferably, you should get a time machine and go back 10 years and oust him sometime in the late aughts, because he did a lot of damage over the, like, he has a massive negative value. what he did to Blizzard is just shocking. Just shocking how badly he's run Blizzard into the ground. I've made this case before, like, Blizzard used to be this endless font of new stuff. Like, they invented...
Not only new stuff, but good new stuff. Like, the best stuff, and also... Right. And also the most cutting-edge stuff.
Right. New genres of games, and esports, and, you know, they didn't invent the MMO, but they invented... They made the MMO that dominated the industry, that shook the industry to its core. A game that was so good, other companies killed themselves trying to compete with it. Like, that's the level of quality that Blizzard had. You're not even trying to kill these companies. You're just so good they die in your presence.
Yeah. It's like turn undead.
And exactly. And now it's been less than 20 years. It's, you know, he's been like, he used to leave Blizzard alone and Blizzard kind of managed itself. But as he's taken it over more and more, these days, all Blizzard does is re-release old stuff, and they're fucking that up. They can't even recreate the good games they used to make. Not only can they not make awesome new stuff, they can't even just repackage their own legacy and sell it to us, to a willing audience. That is a shocking failure, not just in video games, but that is like one of the most appalling management failures of the modern world. Like, to take something worth that much and to make it worth that little. It's one thing if you run Blockbuster. Hey, VHS has died. Streaming came along and killed it. But Bobby Kotick did that damage to his own company in a growing industry. Like, a flourishing industry. Can you imagine, like, at the dawn of the automotive age when cars are selling like crazy and you're running a car company that implodes? Like, how do you do that?
The Edsel? Are we going to go there?
I guess. Like,
I mean, there have been mismanagement failures in every technology in every age. So it's not like he's a uniquely poor manager.
I think he's this generation's great failure, though. Like, we only get a fuck up that big once in a generation.
Yeah, well, there aren't that many beautiful, perfect things to destroy.
Exactly. Exactly. So silly. Do we have time for this last one? I feel like we're running long.
We are running long.
We could save this for next week. Let's do that.
Done.
All right. The risk of having done my Blizzard rant here is that maybe now I won't want to make a video about it. I don't know. We'll see.
You could just take your EA rant and just like voice over Blizzard whenever you say EA and ship it. It'll be fine.
Here's the thing. I did that video about executive salaries are not the problem. And people argued with, no, salaries are the problem. Salaries are the problem. Here's the analogy I came. This is my follow-up to that. It's like somebody was hired by the mob. The mob gave him $10,000 to go and burn down this coffee shop. And your complaint is, $10,000? That's way too much money to burn down a coffee shop. And I'm like, really? That's your problem here?
I would have done it for three.
Right? These overpaid arsonists are the ruin of this industry. So that's my Blizzard rant. Thank you to everybody who sent in questions. If you've got a question for the show, our email is diecast@seamusyoung.com. As a reminder, we record this on Saturday nights. I notice a lot of you sending in questions on Sundays. When you do that, your question can't be answered on that show. Just pro tip.
It's the pre-record show. Call-in show.
Yes! Oh my goodness, that is one of the most brilliant skits ever. That's the only Mr. Show I've ever watched, but I've watched that skit many times. I'll try to remember to link it in the show notes. Anyway, thanks so much to everybody who sent in questions. Say goodbye, Paul.
Goodbye.
Good show. Good show.
We're going to have a stinger about, like, Blizzard to just try to make Solitaire now.
Can you imagine? And it would just be awful. It would be 50 gigabytes and it would have microtransactions in it and voice acting and cutscenes. And it would crash all the time.
Like Hearthstone, but there's no player on the other side.
Right. Right. I was just thinking their most recent Tony Hawk game where, like, the skateboard, you'd do a kickflip and you just, like, rock it into the ground like a nail that had been driven into the ground and your board would shoot up in the air. Like, levels like you'd try and move a card around in Solitaire and it would just get stuck in the tabletop. I'd just freak out as the physics engine screwed up.
Each card has real thickness, but when you pick it up, it like squeezes the card together, so it like fights with itself.
Right. Right. They'd be wrong cards on the board. There'd be like the 13 of staves. And you're like, wait, that's not a card.
The proprietary save system.
Always online.
Okay, I feel like, for real talk though, like, it seems like anybody can make Solitaire now. Like, you could just code it up in like a few minutes.
Right, that's an afternoon project in Unity.
Or even like code it in Python and like have text entry or whatever if you don't care about the graphics.
Right, right.